All right, I think everybody's back in. Good morning, everybody. Acts chapter 27. Just a few more weeks and then we will be out of Acts and we'll be going on to the next book. It's most likely going to be in the Old Testament. I like to jump back and forth. But today's message is don't worry. That's one of those things that's a lot easier said than done. It's one of those things that we like to throw around saying, oh, don't worry about anything, have hope in everything. But when we actually, when push comes to shove, that is a really hard concept for us to grasp as humans. We love to worry about everything. Me, I like to say that I don't stress. Or it takes a lot for me to stress, but I do worry. And so what we're going to do is when we start to worry, it really shows where our relationship is with God, because if we don't worry and we put all of our hope into God, then that means that we're more mature. But does that mean that if you do worry that you're not a mature Christian? No. Just means that we have some working to do. It means that we're not complete, right? And a lot of people, we think of that as being a negative aspect. But to a Christian, if you have work to do, that means that you're just living in reality. If you're a Christian that thinks that you have no more work to be done on you, that you are as good as you are going to get, then you're deceiving yourself. And so that's what we're going to be talking about here with Paul, because Paul is about to become shipwrecked. He's on his way to Rome. He's going to hit some turbulent seas. He's going to give his warnings to the captain, to the commander, and they just ignore him. But even Paul, in this point, at one point, the angel comes to him. He says, "Do not be afraid." And I don't think Paul was necessarily afraid of him for himself, but he's afraid for the crew that was with him. Because God gave Paul the promise that he would make it to Rome, that he would stand trial before Caesar. God didn't give him the promise yet that the rest of the crew would make it. And if you don't know anything about Paul, if you don't remember, Paul is not a guy you want to go sailing with. He has been shipwrecked, as we see in 2 Corinthians. He was shipwrecked 3 times. Most sailors will go their entire life without being shipwrecked once. Paul goes on a couple missionary trips and he's shipwrecked 3 times. So he's not a guy you want to go sailing with. But yet, here we are. When the time came, we set sail for Italy. There's the thing, they shouldn't have gone sailing with him. Paul and several other prisoners were placed in the custody of a Roman officer named Julius, a captain of the Imperial Regiment, or the Augustine Legion. So we don't know much about this guy, other than he's a commander. The Augustine Legion, there was many of them. It wasn't just one legion. There was many legions that had that title. But what they're doing is, why do they then even mention this guy? Well, you have to think about who is the book really writing to when it was written. It was written to people in that area, so they gave this name, this account, for accountability purposes. If you notice, there's a lot of names that are thrown out in the book of Acts. It's all having to do for accountability. Because if they just didn't give names, they said a Roman officer, then how could the people that are trying to disprove Christianity go about it? Well, they would just say, look, you don't give me accurate accounts. So Luke, being a physician, being very detail-oriented, he gave names He gave locations. He gave a time frame of when this would have happened so that people, when they're trying to look into it, they can see that it's true. And then he goes on to say some other names. Like this guy, that guy starts with an A. A Macedonian from Thessalonica was also with us. We went on a ship whose home port was that other place on the northwest coast of the province of Asia, which would also at this point would be Western Turkey. Okay, because if you think about Asia, or at least when I was reading this and I was thinking of Asia proper as what we have as Asia, that's nowhere near the Mediterranean. So how could they be coming from a port in a Mediterranean city out of Asia? Well, it's because it's Western Turkey. So, then picking up, it was scheduled to make several stops at ports along the coast of the province. The next day, when we docked in Sidon, Julius was very kind to Paul and let him go ashore to visit with friends so they could provide for his needs. Now, what's interesting about that part right there is from where they left to get to Sidon, which is a major port, would usually take 2 days sailing to get there, or at least a day and a half. But the fact that they were able to make it in one day means that they had a pretty good wind. They had pretty safe travels. They had pretty smooth sailing so far. Isn't that how our life goes? We love it when things are going our way, when the wind is with us, when things are smooth sailing. It tends to put us in a good mood, right? And that's what Julius was. Julius was in a good mood. He probably thought, oh, look, we're ahead of schedule already. So we're going to get to Rome, no problem. We'll be fine. So he even lets Paul go on shore. A prisoner, he lets him go on shore to go and visit with the other believers to give him what he needs. That's a lot of trust that Julius is putting into Paul. Now, you have to understand, Julius knew that Paul was an innocent man. It's not like they held it a secret when he left Festus and the other governors and Agrippa, King Agrippa. They didn't hide the fact that Paul really should be set free. But since he appealed to Caesar, he had to be sent to Caesar, being a Roman citizen. And so Julius lets him go. He goes off, meets with friends, has his needs taken care of. Paul could have easily just kept walking. He could have just kept going. But Paul, being a man of God, being a man of integrity, he returns. Verse 4. Right? Yeah. Putting out to sea from there, we encountered strong headwinds that made it difficult to keep the ship on course. So we sailed north of Cyprus between the island and the mainland, keeping to the open sea. We passed along the coast of Sicilia and Pamphylia, landing in Myra in the province of Lycia. A lot of words that I hope I pronounced right. But now they had smooth sailing. Now they're getting into the difficult moments. They had to change course from where they originally were going to go, because they were probably just going to sail right across the Mediterranean Sea and stick to the coastal land and stop at those ports. But the wind started getting difficult. It started coming down, and what would happen is in those between the island of Crete and the mainland is it would become a wind tunnel. And so what was happening is they were starting to hit that wind tunnel because they're getting late into the season. It was about to become the time of season that fishermen don't even go out. And so what it did is it drove them to go further out into sea, further out than probably where they wanted to go. So now Julius is probably thinking, great, all that time that we had just made up is now all going to be lost and some. The commander of the ship and the owner of the ship are thinking, great, all this all these goods that we're carrying with us, I hope it doesn't spoil before we get to Rome, because that's their livelihood. And so then, in verse 6, there the commanding officer found an Egyptian ship from Alexandria that was bound for Italy, and he put us on board. So now, he said, wow, I totally missed, sorry. So now, the commander is trying, sort of panicking, because the ship that they were on couldn't make it to Italy in time. And so they found a ship that was strictly going straight to Italy. No more stops, no more layovers, just straight to Italy. And the thing that's interesting about all this is that the Romans, they didn't have to pay these ship owners anything. They just commandeered the ships. Do you think a merchant ship would want to be hauling a bunch of prisoners along with them, along with their goods? No. But Roman soldiers, they had a death grip on the people. Like I've mentioned to you guys before, a Roman soldier could come up to a conquered area and demand that a person carries their backpack 1 mile for them. Now we all know that Jesus says that if you're told to carry it 1 mile, to what? Carry it two. Go the extra mile. They could demand anything. A Roman soldier could pretty much kill a conquered citizen without there being a trial. The whole thing with Jesus is that it wasn't even really a trial. Think about a trial. And Roman courts are similar to our courts, to where there has to be at least two witnesses of a crime. Think about how Jesus was tried. Was that even a trial? Were there witnesses? Were there accusations, like legal accusations that were brought up against Jesus? The biggest thing is that they're trying to say that he was trying to cause a riot among the people, or cause the people to rebel against Caesar. There was no witnesses. There was no evidence. But because Jesus was a Jew and not a Roman citizen, they didn't even have to do a trial. So they crucified him. Paul, on the other hand, the Jewish leaders, they tried to bring up accusations. They tried to bring in witnesses. But because Paul was a Roman citizen, a proper Roman citizen, one that was born a Roman citizen, he had to be tried fully. Not just a wham, bam, now you're dead. No. He had to go through an actual drawn out witnesses, evidence, and everything. And then when he saw that it wasn't going to go his way, Paul then said, I want to go see Caesar. And as a Roman citizen, they can go and see Caesar face to face. But the Romans, over their conquered areas, they had complete authority over. And Rome at this time was the largest nation in the world. They ruled with an iron fist. If there was a riot, it wasn't uncommon for them just to kill everybody and call it over. And so, with a commander being able to come on with his soldiers onto a ship and just say, look, you are taking us to Italy. You're already heading there. You're going to take us there. And there was no promise of compensation at the end. These people, they were just doing it, which means now the prisoners had to be fed, the soldiers had to be fed, and their own crew had to be fed. So now they're consuming all these merchants' food with no compensation in return. How many of you would be happy if a whole bunch of soldiers from Camp Roberts showed up at your doorstep and said, "Feed us. We want to be fed, and you have to house us"? How many of us would be like, "Oh, yay, cool, I get to come up with a bunch of food"? Most of us wouldn't appreciate that. But whereas we can complain, we can deny them, they couldn't. If they complained, the soldiers could then kill the command captain and the owner and just take over the ship. And anybody that would refuse to work for them, anybody that refused to work for them would also be killed. And so they found this. They put them on board. Verse 7. "We had several days of slow sailing, and after great difficulty, we finally neared Cnidus. But the wind was against us, so we sailed across to Crete and along the sheltered coast of the island, past the Cape of Siloam. We struggled along the coast with great difficulty and finally arrived at Fair Havens near the town of Lasea. We had lost a lot of time. The weather was becoming dangerous for sea travel because it was so late in the fall, and Paul spoke to the ship's officers about it." So Paul, remember, he had already been shipwrecked 2 times prior to this. So he knew about what time of year to go and what time of year not to go. He saw that the winds were becoming dangerous. The sea was becoming deathly dangerous. Wow, that's a lot lower than I thought it was going to be. And he was giving them caution. Now, he wasn't acting in the form of a prophet at this point. He was just acting out of knowledge of his own experience of being on the Mediterranean Sea. Paul was not a fisherman. Paul was he dealt with hide and clothes and tents. We can see that earlier in the book of Acts when it was talking about him making a living in some of these cities, that he was a tent maker. But Paul saw that the struggle, saw that the dangers was coming, warned them. In verse 10, "Men," he said, "I believe there is trouble ahead if we go on, shipwreck, loss of cargo, and danger to our lives as well." But the officer in charge of the prisoners listened more to the ship's captain and the owner than to Paul. Now that kind of makes sense, right? Are you going to listen to a hobbyist, or are you going to listen to the person that does this for a living? I think I'm going to listen to the person that does it for a living. It's like, are you going to listen to me on how to build a house, or are you going to listen to a contractor who's actually gone through the skills and the training and everything else on how to build a house? If you listen to me, your house will fall down. I guarantee you it. I am not a construction worker. Now, I can look at something and go, "Well, that doesn't seem right." Whereas a contractor would go, "No, this is exactly how it's supposed to be. This is the strongest point." Me, I would end up with extra items, whereas a contractor would use up all the items. How many of you guys have ever put something together or taken a car apart, put it back together, and found that you had extra parts? I know I have. I don't know how many times I can count that I've put a car back together and I'm like, "Wait, why do I have extra bolts? Eh, it'll be fine." I'm sure, started up, hear for any clanking, we're good. Mile down the road, the car just suddenly dies. I don't know why. Or I can listen to a mechanic who can actually take it apart, put it back together, and it'll run maybe 2 miles, but it'll still run further. Point being, it's natural for the commander not to listen to Paul and to listen to the people that actually do this for a living. But in this case, he probably should have listened to Paul. But the commander, the ship commander, and the owner, they wanted to get their cargo off. They probably listened to Paul and went, loss of product? Wait, what? What are you talking about? No, we'll make it. No loss of product. No loss of cargo. Who are you to say that? So, in verse 12. Right? Is that on verse 12? Yeah. Sorry, I have to look at that every once in a while. And since Fair Havens was an exposed harbor, a poor place to spend the winter, most of the crew wanted to go to Phoenix, further up the coast of Crete, and spend the winter there. Phoenix was a good harbor with only a southwest and northwest exposure. So, if you actually look, some of your Bibles might actually have a picture of Paul's area. In the very middle of the picture, or actually there's a magazine I have around here somewhere that my dad just gave me, shows it, if you want to look at it afterwards. If you look at the island of Crete, where Fair Havens was kind of in a cove, a curved cove, whereas Phoenix was only like near the tip of the island, then it only had two shores it had to deal with, whereas Fair Haven, how many of you have ever been out to Avila? How often is it not windy in Avila? Not very often. Every time I've ever gone to Avila, it's always been windy. We talk about Guadalupe wind. No, Avila wind is much worse. And that's basically what it was. It was this cove to where it was fully exposed to any sort of wind. You had your south, you had your southeast, you had your east, you had your west wind. You had every single wind that could go in there. And it wasn't a very good spot to park. It was a small port. And so they wanted to go up to Phoenix, which was a much bigger port, much safer port for their product. And it would allow for them to be able to do stuff for the 4 months that they were about to be stuck there. They weren't trying to press all the way to Italy. They just wanted to go up a little bit further. And so, how often is it that God tells us, you know what, no, just slow down, be right where you're at, stay there, but we're looking forward, and we're like, no, I want to be there. I want that, but I want it now. I don't want to wait. I want that now. And God's like, no. You go there now, it's just going to be harder. But if you wait, I'll prepare a way for you to get there. We're like, no. I know better, God. Come on, I know that you created the universe and everything, whip-de-doo. I know better than you. We like to think that way. In a public setting, we're like, oh, no. I listen only to God. My will is God's will. Whereas in the private, we're constantly struggling with God. We're constantly fighting back against God. Our flesh is weak. Our spirit is willing, but our flesh is weak. Our spirit wants to follow after God. We want to go to God. We want to do it His way. But our flesh is saying, no. You do it your way. You know better. You know best. There's nothing that could come up against you that you can't handle. And that's what was going on here, is Paul was saying, no, let's stay. I know the troubles that are ahead. I know this. Come on, I've already been shipwrecked twice. How many times have you guys ever been shipwrecked? None. Okay, I've been shipwrecked twice. Let's stay. And they're like, no, let's push on to Phoenix. It's a good harbor. It's big, safe. So then, verse 13. When a light wind began blowing from the south, the sailors thought they could make it. So they pulled up anchor and sailed across to the shore of Crete, but the weather changed abruptly, and a wind of typhoon strength called a northeaster burst across the island and blew us out to sea. Isn't that how it often happens? We see the target, we go for the target, we try to cut some corners to get to that target. We're within reach, almost within reach, and then basically all hell breaks loose. And nothing goes our way. We had such smooth sailing. We thought we could make it. And then everything goes against us. Can't tell you how many times in my life that has happened. I'm only 36 years old, and yet I have had so many times where I thought I was going the right way, just to hit a brick wall. And me being so stubborn and pigheaded, instead of trying to find a way back to God, instead of trying to find a way around that wall, I'm trying to dig through the wall. I'm trying to climb over the wall. I'm trying to dig under the wall. And all that does is that gets you into more heartache. That gets you into more trouble, which causes more stress, more worry, more everything that is negative, to where then it just feels like that wall has now just circled around you, and that's all you can see. And I bet you that's what they're going through right now. They thought they had smooth sailing, and then they hit a typhoon. Not just a little storm. No, they hit a typhoon. And then what did it do? Did it blow them closer to shore? No, it blew them further out to sea. Somewhere where they didn't even want to go. They just wanted to go to Phoenix, just a couple of miles up the coast. Now they're in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea at the wrong time of year. And so, verse 15, the sailors couldn't turn the ship into the wind, so they gave up and let it run before the gale. I'm pretty sure that's not what they tell you in Sailing 101. Just give up. Just go with it. What could possibly go wrong? Verse 16. We sailed along the sheltered side of the small island named Kata, where with great difficulty we hoisted aboard the lifeboat being towed behind us. So this lifeboat that's normally in the water, they didn't want to lose it in this storm, so they hoisted it up onto the boat with them. Now, this isn't some like little lifeboat, some little dinghy lifeboat that can only hold like two or three people. No, this is a full-on lifeboat that could probably hold at least half of the crew on board. So they had to hoist it up. Then the sailors bound ropes around the hull of the ship to strengthen it. They were afraid of being driven across the sandbars of Citrus off the African coast. So they lowered the sea anchor to slow the ship and were driven before the wind. So in the Mediterranean Sea, if you go down towards Africa, about west of Crete towards Africa, there's these sandbars. It's known as the Bermuda Triangle of the Mediterranean Sea. It is a ship graveyard. They knew that they were coming up on that. They could probably see the shores of Africa. And they were like, wait, we don't want to be there. We want to be on the opposite side of the sea. So now they're freaking out. They'd already given up. They gave up all control of the ship to just go wherever the wind wants them to go. And now they see that the wind is driving them straight into the sandbars that will destroy their ship. And so they drop the anchor to slow them down. But it says they were still driven before the wind. They were still being driven by that wind. Verse 18. The next day, a gale-force wind continued to batter the ship. The crew began throwing the cargo overboard. They had to try to lighten the load so that they can actually steer the boat. They're starting to panic at this point. The following day, they even took some of the ship's gear and threw it overboard. Because what could possibly go wrong with throwing parts of the boat off the boat? It's like your car's breaking down. Oh, I don't need this engine. Let me just throw it out. Who needs that? And then the terrible storm raged for May days, blotting out the sun and the stars until at last all hope was gone. So basically, the one guiding thing for sailors back in this day, they didn't have GPS. They couldn't just look up Google, tell them where to go. The stars and the sun, the sky, their map is now gone. They have no clue where they're going, which direction they're going anymore. They're just now sailing to the point of where all hope was lost. Now, was this a God-ordained thing? Did God cause all of this to bring them to some point? Or did it just happen to be nature? I personally believe that it was a mixture of both. They didn't listen to Paul, a God-fearing man. They were more concerned about their money to the point where they had to give up all their money. They were at rock bottom. They had no hope. And then it goes on to say, no one had eaten for a long time. Finally, Paul called the crew together and said, men, you should have listened to me in the first place and not left Crete. This is Paul saying, look, I told you so. Look at the mess you got us into. If you had just listened to me, we wouldn't be here. We would be eating crepes on Crete. They would be fine. So Paul just had to dig in a little bit there. Remember, Paul's still human. How many of us like to, when we tell somebody not to do something or to do it a certain way and they're like, no, I know better. Afterwards, we're like, told you so. Don't be a fool. Now listen to me. That's pretty much what Paul is telling them is, look, you should have listened to me in the first place. You had avoided all this damage and loss, but take courage. None of you will lose your lives, even though the ship will go down, because that's what every captain and owner wants to hear. Great, I'm going to lose everything now. But you won't lose your life. For last night, an angel of the God of whom I belong and whom I serve stood beside me, and he said, Don't be afraid, Paul, for you will surely stand trial before Caesar. What's more, God in his goodness has granted safety to everyone sailing with you. So, at that point, you could tell that Paul, he was probably thinking, great, I'm going to be shipwrecked again. I'm going to destroy another boat again. He was probably worried in the fact that now they're not near really any island. They don't know where they're at. As far as they know, they're in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea and being shipwrecked, having a ship go down in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea doesn't give you much hope of surviving. And so Paul was worried. Now, is Paul a baby Christian? No. He is mature. He is wise. He does have his hope in God. But even having all that, he's still worried a little bit. He didn't worry in the fact that he was afraid that he was going to lose his life because God had already promised him that he was going to stand before Caesar, that he was going to go to Rome. But he's worried about in what condition he's going to get there in. And so God, even when all hope was lost, God sent an angel to Paul to tell him, look, you will stand before trial. You'll be before Caesar. You'll get your day in court. But not only that, God, who looks at you and has kind goodness, is also going to grant everybody that's with you safe passage. None of you will lose your life. The ship will go down. Yeah, you'll lose that. But yeah, at least you'll be alive. So don't be afraid. Verse 25. So take courage, for I believe God, it will be just as he said, but we will be shipwrecked on an island. So, all these guys who probably had never been shipwrecked ever are now going to be shipwrecked. And I have some verses here that has to do with about worrying. And when we get to that point of worrying, you don't have to, but on the back of your bulletin, there is spots to take notes. And Matthew chapter 11, verses 28 through 30, I'm already there, so you don't have to flip. It says, then Jesus said, come to me, all you who are weary and carry heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you. Let me teach you, because I am humble and gentle at heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy to bear, and my burden I will give you is light. He's saying, look, when you're at your darkest point, when the world is just crushing you, look to me. Take on my burden, which is really God taking our burden away. Humble yourself. Look to the light. And he will give you rest. In this time of need, he will give you rest. And then a few chapters to the left, in Matthew chapter 6, verses 25 through 34, it says, this is why I tell you not to worry about everyday life, whether you have enough food or drink, enough clothes to wear. Isn't life more than food and your body more than clothing? Look at the birds. They don't plant or harvest or store food in barns, for your heavenly Father feeds them. And aren't you far more valuable to him than they are? Can all your worries add a single moment to your life? And why worry about your clothing? Look at the lilies of the field and how they grow. They don't work to make their clothing. Yet Solomon, in all of his glory, was not dressed as beautifully as they are. And if God cares so wonderfully for wild flowers that are here today and thrown in the fire tomorrow, he will certainly care for you. Why do you have so little faith? So don't worry about these things, saying, what will we eat? What will we drink? What will we wear? These things dominate the thoughts of unbelievers. But your heavenly Father already knows all your needs. Seek the kingdom of God above all else and live righteously, and he will give you everything you need. Or in some versions, he'll say he'll give you all these things, the clothing, the food, the shelter, all that stuff that you need to live, he'll provide. So don't worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will bring its own worries. Today's trouble is enough for today. So what Jesus is saying is like, look, when you worry, because we all will worry at some point, there will come something in our life that will cause us to worry. When you worry, go to God. Once again, that's one of those things that's a lot easier said than done. Because when we're going through the trials, the turmoil, the everything, how easy is it to go, oh wait, let me just stop and go to God? That's not an easy thing to do. And Jesus understood that. That's why he was saying, when you worry, because you will worry, remember these things. We've all been there. We've all had it to where it seems like everything is coming up against us. Our whole life is falling apart. Everything is going to shambles. And it is very easy for us just to get into the self-pity. It's very easily for us to turn inwardly. But God is saying, look, all you have to do is just remember that I'm there. You have to just think back to me. And in Psalm 55, verse 22. It goes on, says, give your burdens to the Lord, and He will take care of you. He will not permit the godly to slip and fall. So, give your burdens to Him. When things go wrong, once again, like I said, this is a lot easier said than done. It's a lot easier to say from the pulpit than to actually apply to your life. Give it to God. I know that in my life, when I finally give it to God, when I finally say, you know what, I'm done. When I'm like these sailors where I've given up all hope, I'm like, you know what, I might as well just throw in the towel. Forget it. And then I'm like, God, help me. Out of desperation, I cry out to God. God has never let me down. For some reason, then a peace just washes over me. Not a peace of saying, okay, everything is going to be honky-dory. It's going to be smooth sailing from here. But it's more like, look, there's a lot of pieces to pick up. There's a lot of hard road ahead. But I'm there. That's the peace that God gives. He helps us pick up the pieces to our lives. It's much like my children, how I help them clean up. No, it's more like I am cleaning up. And they're just sitting there watching, waiting for me to say, okay, now take this, go throw this away, put this there. That's how God is. God is already picking up all the pieces to our life, and He's handing them to us and saying, look, this is what I want you to do. Go, throw this one away, get rid of it. This one, go put on the shelf. This one, take care of it this way. Put these things away. But we like to say that we're really part of helping, right? It'd be a lot easier for God just to take care of it Himself. But just like as parents, we take it and we have our kids help, which probably takes three times as long than us just doing it. But we have them interact with us so that they can learn, they can grow, they can be shaped and see how it is that we want it. And the same thing with God is as He's putting our lives back together, He's having us help so that way we can learn, we can mature, we can grow to where when next time our life just starts falling apart, we can go easier back to Him. It's not going to be perfect every single time. And then from Acts, if we turn over to the right, to 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 6 through 8. We say, so humble yourselves under the mighty power of God, and at the right time He will lift you up in honor. Give all your worries and cares to God, for He cares about you. Stay alert. Watch out for your great enemy, the devil. He prowls like a roaring lion, looking for someone to devour. Stand firm against him and be strong in your faith. Remember that your Christian brothers and sisters all over the world are going through the same kind of suffering you are. So what Peter's trying to encourage them is saying, look, humble yourself before God. When you worry, give it to God. But then he goes on to there, once you give your cares to God, is it done? Are you finished? Are you just out of that turmoil? No, he's saying stay alert. Because the enemy is prowling like a lion. He's looking to devour you. How many of you know how a lion hunts? How many of you have ever watched a National Geographic, Animal Channel, or anything about lions? One thing I found out about lions, and this was a few years ago, is that lions, they don't go after the strongest animal. If there's a herd, they will sit back, they will watch, and they will look for one that is wounded or one that is weaker than the rest, and they will go after that one. They will look to separate that one from the rest of the herd or rest of the group so that it could be easier for them to take out. A lot of times, a lion will become a scavenger to where if there's already a dead animal and there's meat still left on it, they'll eat that. Easy prey. Free food. And so do you think it's any shocker that God would use a lion as an example? God uses that lion because that's how Satan works. That's how the devil works in our life. He waits for us to be at our weakest moment. He waits for us to separate ourselves from fellow brothers and sisters. He waits for us to separate ourselves from believers. He waits for us to become alone for him to attack. He waits for us to give up all hope. He waits for us to worry so much about it that it's easy for him to come in and add to that doubt, add to that worry. Because we have to remember that the sin that comes in our life, we can't blame it on the devil. We can't blame it on the demons. We can't blame it on other things. Because the sin that we bring into our lives is brought to our lives by ourselves. Satan has to do very little work for us to sin. And then last is Philippians chapter 4, verse 16. And then we'll get back into the thing, but this is having to do with worrying and how, really, when we think about it, this is how Paul dealt with worrying. I think I wrote down the wrong verse. It's all right. Wrote down the wrong verse. But regardless of what it is that when we worry, what Paul did was he went before God. An angel of the Lord sent an angel to Paul to comfort him. He did that because Paul was looking to God. That was one thing that God, I mean, that Paul always did, is he always pointed people back to God, and he always tried to go back to God himself. When he was imprisoned and chained to a wall, he started praising God. When he was beaten and cast out of a city, left for dead, he brushed himself off and went back in for God. On all of his mission trips, he always looked to God. When the people were wanting to kill him and persecute him and jump him, he always went back to God saying, look, God will provide for me. God is not done with me yet. If you go and read his epistles, he even tells them that he wishes that he was dead. He wishes that he was gone from this earth. He wishes that he was with the Lord. But because the Lord has plans for him, he's not done. And he's not saying that to boast, saying, look, I'm some great person. But he's saying, look, God's not done with me yet. So then, oh, I think I hit a couple buttons. All right. So, going on, we're going to finish up chapter 27 here. About midnight on the 14th night of the storm, as we were being driven across the Sea of Adria, which is in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea, The sailors sensed land was near. How they sensed land was near, I don't know. They dropped a weighted line and found the water was 120 feet deep. But a little later, they measured again and found it was only 90 feet deep. So they see that they're fastly approaching land. They see that they went to 120 feet. They dropped by 30 feet a little bit of time later. And so at this rate, they were afraid they would soon be driven across the rocks along the shore. So they threw out 4 anchors from the back of the ship and prayed for daylight. So now they're having hope, but at the same time, they don't want to be cast across the rocks. Now, what island, what land they're coming upon, they don't know. They just know land is near, and usually when land is near, there's going to be rocks, there's going to be coral, there's going to be a reef, there's going to be something that is going to be in the water that they have to avoid. Then they threw out 4 anchors, not just 1, not just 2, but 4, to really slow them down, to stop them. Then the sailors tried to abandon the ship. They lowered the lifeboat as though they were going to put out anchors from the front of the ship. But Paul said to the commanding officers and soldiers, "You will all die unless the sailors stay aboard." So now, once again, Paul is telling them not to go with their instinct. And since he was right last time, I think they gave a little bit more bearing or more credibility to what he has to say. And the fact that he said that they'll die. How many of you would want to die? Not many. So the soldiers had to step in. So the soldiers cut the ropes of the lifeboat and let it drift away. Just as day was dawning, Paul urged everyone to eat. "You have been so worried that you haven't touched food for 2 weeks. He said, how many of us can go 2 days without food? Imagine going 2 weeks. Now, you have to think about it. It's not that they didn't want to eat. But how many of you have ever been on a cruise ship? Or how many of you have ever gone out to deep sea fishing out of Port San Luis? Wow, nobody? You guys really need to get out. But if you've ever, I've been on a cruise ship, never been deep sea fishing, but when you're out in the ocean, the waves, just subtle waves, get that boat rocking. Now, we've all seen the news video to where it's like the front of a cruise ship like goes underneath the water, and we've seen the videos to where they're having to put towels up against the doors to keep the wind and the rain and the water from coming into the main part of the ship. Now, as you're being tossed around, how likely are you going to be like, wow, I want something to eat. I want to put something in my stomach. No, they probably weren't eating due to the fact that if they ate anything, it'd probably just come right back up. It'd be a waste. And probably the food that they had wasn't very good. This trip that they were on was probably only going to take them a couple of weeks to get from Egypt to Crete and then to Italy. So they didn't have that much food. So the food that they had was probably going bad, probably didn't taste very good. Remember, they threw a lot of the cargo and stuff overboard already. So he's telling them, look, eat something, anything, get something in your stomach. Look, at the storm is settling down. We can actually see daylight now. Dawn is coming. So please eat something. In verse 34. Please eat something now for your own good, for not a hair on your heads will perish. Then he took some bread, gave thanks to God before them all, and broke off a piece and ate it. I don't think this is the whole fish and loaves night where they just had an abundance amount of food. But what he was doing is he took this opportunity saying, look, he gave all the glory back to God. He blessed the food. He broke it in front of them. They weren't complaining about it. They weren't fighting him on it. Much like how our country today, if you bring up anything with having to do with God or Christianity, you'll get people that will fight against you tooth and nail, even till their dying breath. They will fight you. But Paul, he blessed the food, he broke it, gave it to them, and they ate it. Then everyone was encouraged and began to eat. All 276 of us who were on board. So it's not just like some bare-boned crew. 276 people on this boat. After eating, the crew lightened the ship further by throwing the cargo of wheat overboard. So they just threw the rest of their food overboard. When morning dawned, they didn't recognize the coastline, but they saw a bay with a beach and wondered if they could get to shore by running the ship aground. So they cut off the anchors and left them in the sea. Then they lowered the rudders, raised the foresail, and headed towards shore. But they hit a shoal and ran the ship aground too soon. The bow of the ship struck fast, while the stern was repeatedly smashed by the force of the waves and began to break apart. So remember, Paul said, nobody would die, right? God would not allow anybody to die. But the soldiers didn't really take that. They said, it's great, now good, we're made it to shore. And then it says, the soldiers wanted to kill the prisoners to make sure they didn't swim ashore and escape. Now, why would they care about them escaping at this point? Because you also have to remember, they were still held to Roman law. If a soldier lets a prisoner go, then they would be put to death. They would have to take the price of that prisoner on themselves. And most of these people that were on this ship were probably heading to Rome to go into the Colosseums or into the arena. Because if they're just going to kill them, they're going to kill them back at their land. But no, they're selling these prisoners to Rome for a reason. But the commanding officer wanted to spare Paul, so he didn't let them carry out their plan. Then he ordered all who could swim to jump overboard first and make for land. The others held on to planks of debris from the broken ship, so everyone escaped safely to shore. Or some versions will say that the others helped them to shore. Regardless, everybody made it to shore. Paul worried. They all worried. The rest of them didn't really put their trust in God. But Paul did. Paul gave them the reassurance. He kept being that encouragement into the darkness. When everything was going wrong, he was being that encouragement. He's being that light. He's constantly pointing back to God. And that's our job as Christians, is that when we have our faith, our maturity in Christ so strong that even though everybody else is panicking around us as things are falling apart, we can constantly be pushing them and encouraging them to look back to God. Constantly encouraging them to keep pushing forward. Because remember what Paul did. Paul, he said, look, you guys haven't eaten in 14 days. He blessed the food. He broke it. He gave it to some people. He himself started eating it. That encouraged them to eat and to get their strength up. Paul didn't know that they were going to have to swim. Paul didn't know what was coming up, but he knew that something was coming and they all needed to be ready for it. As a Christian, we don't necessarily know what's coming up. We don't know where this world is going to go. But we know something is coming. We know that we need to be prepared for it. We know that we need to be spiritually strengthened for it. We know that we need to be ready and to be stay alert. That's why if you go and read through all the epistles that Paul wrote, he is constantly telling them to be encouraged. He's constantly telling them to be ready for the fight. He's constantly telling them to be strengthened. And he tells them in 1 Corinthians, he says, look, train like an athlete. Be ready. Don't shadow box anymore, but be ready to actually do battle. And so when we get past the point of us worrying, and we turn back to God, and God gives us that peace and that rest and that reassurance, He will also give us the strength to withstand the wiles of the devil. He'll give us the strength to combat against. Because you guys have to remember, we're in a battle. It's not just us going through life and trying to survive or trying to make it. It is us trying to battle back against this world. We can see the direction that the world is going. We don't know how bad it's going to get or how quickly it's going to get bad. We just know that it is constantly going in a direction away from God. And we have to be ready to do battle to bring God back into this world. And if you're worrying about every single part of your life, you're not focusing on the battle. You're not focusing on what God has for us. Jesus said that you'll be persecuted, you'll be hated, you'll be despised, people will want you dead. That's just a given for Christianity. That's a given for believers. And so we can't throw a fit when this world is turning away from God. But instead we can be the light unto the darkness. We can be in the encouragement to those that are hopeless. Much like what Paul was here. When they were all out of hope, he had encouragement. He had a vision. He had a word from God. And that's what we are to be. Once we get past the worrying, once we get past ourselves, we can be that light in the darkness. Because now we have put on the full armor of God. We put on Jesus in our life. And we now are that beacon of light for Him. Let's pray. God, we just praise You for this morning. I just ask that You allow us to go our separate ways. Allow us to be encouraged by what You have for us. Allow us not to worry about our life, but to be re-strengthened by our hope, Lord God. Allow us just to renew our faith in You daily. Allow us just to give it all up to You. And we praise You for the freedoms that You've given us in this country and the freedoms that You've given us in life. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, have a good day, guys. Hopefully we'll see you guys next week.